This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, I ate 10 pancakes this morning, so they were just so good, you know, that I walked around in the woods for a while and just looking, I looked under boards and tried to find some snakes and things like that, you know, and I just walked around, went down to the pond and said good morning to the turtles that were all out there. You know, there's lots of them down there. And turtles have a funny way. They speak with their eyes. And I'm telling you something that happened with Coco, what Coco said to me. One time I brought her a turtle, a big turtle from here, and I held it right up in front of her. We're this close, a little bit close, half this distance. And I hold the turtle up in front of Coco, and she's looking at it, and I'm looking at Coco. And Coco, you know, is obviously something's going on between Coco and this turtle. And I said, and then I said, Coco, what's going on with this turtle? And she said, through sign language, I don't know sign language, I only know one thing, love. But through sign language to one of the translators who was sitting beside me, she signed something. And the caregiver said to me, Sophia said, she just said, turtles talk with their eyes. So you look into a turtle's eyes, and what do you hear? I mean, you hear there's something going on with a turtle in the eyes. You know, you look in. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Benjamin, you and I look at each other, and you know, there's something going on with our eyes. You know, we don't need words to do it. You know, so it's just kind of a. You know, they're you know, it's like. Some of the trees around here are so. They're so sentient, you know. They tell you a voice, and you hear it in your head, just as clear as if you know you spoke something words to me like that, you know. And you know, sometimes, you know, I feel Coben come to me in that kind of a way, and he says something. I ask him a question, you know, like when I go over to the shrine over there, you know, and just am quiet there, maybe I'll ask Coben a question, something, you know, like a. What am I going to talk about at the Dharma talk today? You know, I've been thinking. I had all these nice pancakes this morning. I walked in the woods, and I still am not hungry. And you know, and he talks with his smile a lot. You know, Coben was friends with everybody. You know, when you'd go to the gas station with him to get gas in your car, or you know, when you'd go shopping with him, or you know, you'd play with him and his kids. It was a smile that he had. I mean, except when he was being chased by his wife, you know, when she was mad at him, you know, and then he would get kind of a terrified look in his eyes. She was very fierce, but she was fun. I guess I'm just feeling like that my encounter with Coben was something which I'm trying to encourage you to make connection or to just kind of, I'm trying to share something, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, I may die tomorrow, who knows, I may die on the way home tonight, I don't know, but, you know, I just want to, it's something to me, I'm feeling a need or an interest to kind of pass on some of the things that Coben helped me with, you know, and just, you know, in my life, you know, like, one time I was teaching at the Stanford Children's Center, and you know, it's sometimes parents, they get so worried about their children, you know, that it's really hard on the teacher. And you know, I was having a hard time with somebody at that time, and you know, I went and I told Coben, you know, I think I'm going to quit teaching. And he said, no, don't quit teaching. You're a genius at it. And you know, that was a moment. You know, it was early on in my teaching career. I'd just been married. You know, I had a newborn baby. And was just, you know, it was a time that he was able to see something about me and help me, you know, don't quit. You know, he didn't explain, didn't give me any advice about how to, you know, negotiate difficulties with parents and of children in your class. You know, he just said, don't. And, you know, now looking back on it, you know, some of those people who were children that I taught when they were 3 or 4 years old now have children of their own, and they hire me to come and help and take the group of homeschoolers to various places, like including Jikoji, you know. And so I see that, you know, the influence of what Coben said to me that one time when I brought a problem to him, And I mean, you can, if you practice going to visit Koban at his shrine and talking to him, you know, you'll hear a voice in your head sometimes, and you can get answers to your questions. You know, should I leave my wife? Should I leave my husband? You know, important questions like that. I mean, you can just go and chat. You know, Koban liked. There are things that Koban liked. You know what I was going to say? I was going to say Koban liked to smoke pot, but you know, mostly like I said, you know, it's legal for everybody like that. You know, so you can bring him something. You know, you can leave him something on his altar over there, and you know, make a present a present for him or something like that. You know,
might not be there long.
It might not, but then again, he doesn't. He, since he's everywhere, he can smoke it through you. Enjoy it. But anyway, I mean, just, you know, bring him a little present. You know, think you're going to, you know, actually going to visit a person. You know, bring something, bring some tea, bring, you know, he at one point, he used to drink coffee like mad. You know, sometimes, well, there's this other Zen teacher, Jakusho Kwong, and Bill Kwong to me. Bill would come down and visit with Koban every week. And, you know, Bill had said, Koban, will you please teach me the Blue Cliff record? You know, Koban had that. It's a collection of 100 koans and commentaries on them. And Koban, this was what Koban was needed to. His dad required him to sit while the kids were playing outside and memorize this whole book. And you'd ask him a question from the book. He encouraged me to ask questions from it. Like, for example, there was one that was in there when I looked at this book. That it's about. Yakujo was a Chinese Zen master, and he and a disciple were standing beside a pond, like this pond here, and a pair of ducks took off from the pond and flew away. And Yakujo, the Zen master, said to his student, "What are they doing?" And the student said, "They're flying away." And Yakujo grabbed him by the nose and tweaked his nose, and he gave a cry of pain and attained enlightenment. So you may think that a pair of ducks are just flying off like this, but you know, when you have a teacher, you know, like, he's a good teacher over there, he'll tweak your nose. You know, so it's just, you know, like, when Koban ordained my wife, he gave her an ordination name of Blue Lotus, a very beautiful name. And he said to me, make Tina your master, make her your teacher. And we went through a really rough time in our marriage. And then we realized that since both of us had met living in a monastery together, you know, with many other 55 other people, that we, you know, now that we bought houses for our children and they were not any longer with us, that we were actually free to do what we had originally dreamed of doing when we first met, to go and practice Zazen in retreat in a cave in the desert. This was our marriage dream. And, you know, after everybody was gone, and then we had this difficult time in our marriage, and so we said, all right, we're going to swim or sink. So we went, you know, we had bought some land for one of our sons down in the desert, and he built a yurt on it, and he said we could go live there, and we would get up at midnight every day, every morning, and practice. And my wife in another life had lived in a nunnery in Tibet, and the abbess had read aloud from Buddhist scriptures to her. That was the practice at that monastery. They didn't do meditation, they didn't do services, this is what they did. And so she said, I'm gonna be the teacher here. You're gonna be my student. If you don't, get out, and I'm going to get back to live at Zen Center. You know, so we're out in the middle of nowhere in this wonderful place, and this is what we did for 5 years. And then she passed away. And I came here. And this place in the you know, sometimes things, you know, like Koban said to me. It was at a birthday party at one of the kids' houses, kids at his house. And I was kind of, you know, I'm not much of a socializer. And so I was standing over on some steps a little bit off to the side. And Koban came over to me and he said, my understanding of Zen practice is making connections within the Sangha. Okay? My wife passes away. my life feels like it's in shambles. You know, my son gets one of my sons, whom I'm staying in his garage that he fixed up into a mother-in-law's, father-in-law's apartment. You know, it doesn't work. I come up here and Mike says, oh, you can live here. And, you know, and so I come in here. But in the sangha, when everything, when it was just so difficult for me that I was just, you know, it was kind of like you're sort of in a place where you might not make it by yourself. You know, and you know, I would come back from horseback riding with a friend, and I was just in absolute tears. I was just sobbing away, and you know, and all these and Doug and these people who lived here, you know, they came and they put their arms around me and they took care of me and they, you know, they brought me a cup of tea or you know, they did these kinds of things for me. And I have to say that what Koban said to me, my understanding of Zen practice is making connections within the sangha. It came alive for me. So we all here have that element of that, you know, the temple of the light of compassion. We can feel for ourselves and we can take care of those people. And you know you meet somebody up here, you come and hang out up here, you know, you have a bad time, you know, you go beat somebody up or go to get drunk in a bar or something like that, or you can come up here to Jikoji and maybe somebody will take care of you. Or somebody will just be nice to you in a kind of way that, you know, makes you feel like, you know, it's going to be all right. I don't know, you know, like I'm not a great scholar. You know, I kind of tend to talk more about my own experiences in meditation practice. You know, as you, Koban said to me, you know, this month is the 51st anniversary that I met Koban. He said to me, after many years, Zazen will become the power of your life. And, you know, and now, you know, I look back over my life and I see how I don't know how people can make it without Zazen. You know, it's just, you know, try to sit a little bit each day. You know, find some quiet moment just to sit down. You know, you can go outside and do it, or you can come up here. Or I remember one time when one of Koban's senior disciples, her name was Sonia Margulis. She's gone now, but. But she was the one who introduced Koban to Trungpa Rinpoche. And when one day when Trungpa and Koban and I and some other people were over at Sonia's house, she had in the kitchen there was a counter that was about, you know, waist height. And folded up on the right underneath that thing was one of these cushions, one of the square zabutons and a zazen cushion, a zafu. And it just, I'm passing on this teaching to you because, you know, he looked at Sonia and he indicated that. And in that way, he communicated his appreciation, approval, encouragement to sit regularly. And, you know, Sonia and I were, you know, she's much older than I, but we were friends and after her husband passed away. I remember when her husband had a heart attack and he was taken to Stanford Emergency, and Koban went to visit him in the hospital, and he said to this husband, this man, this very nice man, he looked at him and right into his eyes, and he said, "Are you ready?" And soon after that he passed away. You know, so it's a, you know, it's just like these little things that you know, they're not found in written down in the scriptures or something like that. You know, it's just, you know, like I have not written many of these things down. It's just like there are things that happened between Koban and me, things that I witnessed about him teaching without words, kind of, you know, expressing appreciation to Sonia. So we, passing on Koban in front of us all, you know, having a regular place in our wherever we live. To have our meditation cushion so that, you know, even if we don't sit down, we can look at it, we can touch it. you know, but we can maybe just, so we don't have to make a special place or clear a place for it. Here's the place that's already set aside for meditation. And there's a certain degree of power of just in place, you know, the space of a place that regularly gets sat in has a certain quality to it. Like now this Zendo has that kind of quality about it. You know, when it was first here and people were living in here and stuff like that, it did not have that kind of a quality to it. And now, but now you go to it and you see it. And even where Haiku Zendo used to be down in Los Altos, where Suzuki came and gave those talks that were the Zen Mind Beginner's Mind talks, it's no longer used as a Zendo, but Mary Kay, you know, and her husband who own the property, you know, it's her, she's a landscape architect, and so she's has converted it into her office for that kind of thing. And, you know, three or four years ago, John Adraka, a Zen teacher who was living in Jokoji at that time, she said she asked me if I would take her down and show her Haiku Zendo. She wanted to be there. She had received transmission from Suzuki's lineage, and so I took her down there and introduced her to Les K. And we went back in there with Mary and Les K. And you could still feel the presence of the meditation that had been done for so many years in this small room. You know, there's on the other side of this wall right here, the movable wall. You can come in through the door as you come in. There's you know, chairs and there's other meditation cushions of different heights and sizes, and you can go in there and help yourself to one. You know, if the cushion you're sitting on is too low or too high for you, then you can go and find one that's more suitable for you and bring it out in here and do that. You know, one of the things Copen, you know, encouraged me about a lot, because I had so much difficulty, you know, when I was first starting out, you know, I would just shake like crazy and I'd just be exhausted by sitting. I just would have so much pain, you know, and he would say, and he was very kind, you know, he would say, you know, it's important to find the right height for your meditation cushion, you know, experiment with different sizes and see if you find one that's the best. And, you know, so I still do that. You know, recently I always used to sit in this position, Seiza, for a long time. Recently, the one session we had here, and, you know, I had to go and sit in a chair for the first time. And, you know, it's a, you know, when I was a young man, I thought, I'm never going to sit in a chair like that. I'm always going to sit like this. I'm not going to be old and cranky. But, you know, you kind of realize that sort of thing. You know, and so, you know, like to devote yourself to meditation practice is something that, I guess when I invited Coben over there, you know, we three went over, these two young ladies and I went over to, and I introduced them to Coben's shrine, and I invited him to come and join to the Dharma talk today. And now suddenly all the things that are coming out of my mouth are things that are kind of, you know, memories and stuff that, you know, are, you know, directly from him. But, you know, just like that, you know, finding the right height for your meditation cushion. But when I was about to go to Tassajara, he told me to train at Tassajara in the monastery. He gave me one little piece of advice when I went there. He said, and it's not very complicated, but it's still with me here today, and I bring it with him. You know, he said, see if you can get a taste of pure practice. And so what is pure practice? I mean, in a way, you know, what's the ordination verse that I have on the back of my rakasu? You know, it says, the first line of it says, in my heart, there is nothing that I seek. This is the way. So pure practice. You know, if you want lots of different stuffs, you know, then that's not pure practice. You know, I guess it's related, you know, that, you know, in our, when we are ordained, we receive precepts, 10 precepts, and the same for, you know, the lay ordination or the same for priest ordination. And the first group of precepts relates to the body, you know, no killing, no stealing, no, and usually people translate it as no sexual misbehavior. But Coben said, no, it's not, that's not good. He said it doesn't apply to monks because monks don't have sexual behavior. And, you know, he said, means no attaching to fulfillment. No attaching to fulfillment, in a way, means if you cultivate pure practice and you don't scatter your desires all over the world, you know, then you have pure practice. You can devote yourself to just one thing, which is our meditation practice. And I think that having a devotion like that is very important. you know, it's like I'm lucky that I have this latter part of my life here, you know, when I don't have a lot of commitments outside. You know, I can really work to be a bodhisattva and, you know, really try to be helpful to people. And you know, I think that the second precept about no stealing, I guess mostly I hear it being said around here as being, you know, no taking what is not given, freely given. But I think it means, it is about being a man of peace, being a woman of peace. I think it means, you know, if you steal something from somebody, if I come over there and pick your pocket, it's not going to make you peaceful, right? You know, if you take something from somebody else, you may not feel peaceful. You may feel like you feel the person's energy who's disturbed by that you took something from him or her. You know, and so it's about, you know, these precepts, these three precepts are about maintaining pure practice in a way, these three ways of maintaining pure practice. And I was going to say, as we were chanting the sutra on knowing the better way to live alone, you know, I was thinking, it came to me that living alone is also about pure practice. It doesn't mean just living in a cave or something like that, or a cell. You know, it means to be able to be alone with ourself, you know, wherever we are, you know, even in a crowded city or in a zendo like this. You know, we just, you know, it's how we live. You know, it's like, you know, we have this wonderful place, Jikoji, here, and we have this wonderful teaching on meditation, and, you know, it can help us to live peaceful lives. You know, the thing that I have a gift for being able to see people who have passed away and convey things from them to other people. And when at the last moment of your life, if you have been practicing pure practice and been living a peaceful life, you will, you know, and you don't have a lot of regrets or a lot of desires. You know, my mother, when at the end of her life, I had to talk to her about this. Son talking to a mother, yeah, sure. She said, I have a bucket list. I have 10 things that I want to do before I die. And, you know, and she passed away unexpectedly before she was able to do those things. And I said, Mom, you know, that's not, you know, have is something that you want, you know, living a peaceful life, making the people around you have a peaceful life. It seems to me more important than going and seeing the Eiffel Tower or something like that, you know, I feel like I have a sense in my life that I've been able to do everything that I wanted to do in my life. You know, one of the big things in my life was always, you know, I'm an outdoor person. You know, I like to go to the most wild, remote places and be in places where nobody has been in years and years and years, and find things that have been left there for a century. And, you know, Indian things, for example, old bottles, or, you know, just, you know, the feeling of a place. You know, you walk into a place, as you practice meditation, your mind is going to get very free and clear, and you're going to be able to sense. When you go to a place, you can sense that, you know, you'll be able to sense, you know, like there's a bad guy around the corner. I mean, actually, this happens. You know, you'll be able to sense that a person has been in this building or not in this building for a long period of time. You know, you go to a place and it's this, you get a sense that, I mean, it's just, you know, our meditation practice, you know, it's about, you know, we lose things. We get free of things. We get rid of we drop off our bucket list. You know, what I mean is that for myself, I find out what is the true wish of my heart for this life. What is the true wish? You know, to be able to, you know, I feel one of my favorite scriptures is the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch. The Sixth Patriarch was a really gifted Zen teacher in China, and he was he got to see to have an audience with the Fifth Patriarch, a very powerful person, teacher in his way too. And the Fifth Patriarch said to him, "Why have you come to see me?" And Daikon Eino, this Sixth Patriarch to be, said, "I only want one thing. I want to become a Buddha. You know, and as I practice, as my practice continues with the help of all of you and Jikoji and Koban and the Buddha and ducks on the pond, you know, it's that I encounter this feeling in myself. There's nothing in my heart that I seek. You know, there's something, but there is something in my heart that I have. And it's that I want to become a Buddha, you know. And I mean, if we're clear about this kind of thing, you know, it will guide us. A funny thing happened to me, you know, a while ago. I was on the truck that I had before, the one that I have now. I had a bumper sticker on the back, you know, I was teaching at Stanford, and I had a Stanford parking permit on the back. And I was driving down through Los Altos, and a policeman, you know, flashed his lights, and I pulled over, and he pulled over. And he came around to me, and he said, "Do you teach at Stanford?" He looked at me, and then something changed in his mind. And I guess he saw that I wasn't, you know, a bad guy, or wasn't drunk, or whatever he was looking at, whatever he thought, you know. And he looked in my eyes and he said, "Do you teach at Stanford?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Drive carefully." That was it. I mean, it's just, and I think that in our meditation practice, you know, it cuts away, you know, things that could possibly harm us. You know, it is a very harmless practice that we have here, and as you practice more and more, you find that these, you know, you can see something that might be hazardous before it gets hazardous, and you can stay away, or it sees you before you get to it, and you are able to be safe like that. You know, it's just, you know, and I think that's something of paying attention in your life to those kinds of things, that sort of miraculous things that happen. I mean, like the other day, I was driving down Highway 84 from where I live and the Gorilla Foundation down into town to get gas or something or other, and I come around a curve, and there's a two-lane road, and there are two cars both coming to me in my direction like this, and I just thought, Buddha. And somehow that car that was in my lane, coming my way very fast, trying to pass the other car, fell back behind the first car, and I mean, it was like, it was kind of miraculous what happened like that, and it almost makes me think that the world that we live in is kind of like the Buddha says, a dream world that we live in, and that actually by our spiritual power we are able to prevent things happening, like a head-on crash, you know, coming around a corner like that, you know, because it's our practice cuts through the dream world and reveals what's actually, you know, the protection that we actually have from our practice. Were there any questions? Yes, Raymond.
So recently I have been, thank you for your talk. You brought a couple of points up that I wanted to ask you a question about. The ducks on the pond.
Yes.
What, do the turtles eat them?
No.
They're not snapping turtles?
No.
They're the western box turtle?
No, western pond turtle.
Western pond.
Pond turtle.
So how did they get here?
They're native here. Soon after Jimmy Rapley built that pond in the 50s, Jimmy was known up here on Skyline as the last of the old time Skyline cowboys, and he had all the stories on the ranch where he lived up the road here. His family homesteaded it, and you know, the last grizzly in the Santa Cruz Mountains was killed. And you know, when I expressed interest in it, he actually was able to. One of his descendants who lives up in Oregon has the big canine teeth of this grizzly bear on a necklace, and I got a photograph of it. And so Jimmy said that soon after that pond was built and began to fill, that the pond turtles began appearing. And I sometimes find that these western pond turtles, especially, they will go up to the headwaters of a drainage, and they'll go over the top of a ridge and down into another drainage, another watershed. And Lena and I were on our evening walk down here a few weeks ago. We were coming back on Old Skyline there, the trail, and we saw this turtle. It was a western pond turtle with a yellow nose. It was hurrying along the trail in the direction of the pond. And so we said, oh, this is very nice. It's probably going to the pond. And I picked it up and we let it go in the pond. And so it joined all of its friends. And now it lives there.
So they do that. They travel to other ponds?
They do.
Because I have like 8. And they come up in the morning and they're like little birds, you know. And I'm like, turtle, turtle. And they'll swim over and I feed them. And they look at me, you know, like they're like, oh, there she is, you know, that she's got.
Yeah, I think they're.
But a couple of them have escaped, mm-hmm. and then I see them in the road, you know. Yeah. So I pick them up and get them back in the pond. But I don't know if they're going outside the water to lay eggs, or what they're leaving such a nice pond.
Yeah, they just wander.
They just wander. Yeah. And then recently, I had a mama duck. Hatched 6 babies, and so they're in the pond with the turtles. And
the duck had six babies. Yeah,
she laid eggs somewhere and came to the pond.
Yeah,
so then the morning I'm there, I've got this mama and all the babies, right? So she's sitting on the rock, and so I look up what will eat baby ducks, and so I waded out into the pond. I put my compost bin out there with a little door so she'd have a place to like den for the day, maybe get out of the water on this rock, because she was on the rock anyway. I don't know if that was a good idea, but so the next morning I come and there's 5 ducks. And then the next morning, so the term sitting duck, you know, I mean, all the ducks were gone. And then there's mom crying, you know, and it's like, I'm sorry, mom. I don't know what happened to your babies. And then I see this big hawk fly over. And I'm thinking, well, that's probably it. I mean, I don't know what takes the ducks. Turtles, they say turtles do.
Some kinds of turtles do. But in my experience, the western pond turtles do not.
Good. I didn't think my turtles ate those ducks. Because habitating in the same pond for days.
Well, this
anyway, it really made me upset that my little ducks were gone. That's what I thought you had. Must have been the hawk, you think? It was the hawk?
Hawks do take baby ducks. And we have the bird-eating hawks here, the accipiters. We have 2 species here, and I see them almost every day. There's 3 groups of hawks that we have here. The falcons have long, sharp, pointed wings and long tails. And they just eat mammals. And then there's the beautios, the like the red-tailed hawk that have big, they're soaring hawks, and they eat mammals, not birds. And they're the accipiters, which are the sharp-shinned and the Cooper's hawks, and they just eat birds. They have short, fat wings and long tail, and they... And their approach is that there will be a group of birds, like say juncos in a bush, and they'll fly at the right through the bush at high period, and then come out the other side with a bird in their claw. They're bird eating; they just eat birds, so they do eat.
Now you'll have to come visit my pond and see if you can identify these turtles. They come up every morning. I don't think so.
There's a question from Laura online.
Yes?
Yes, hello. Hi. Thank you for your talk. I just wanted to share that I'm having an interesting experience this weekend, in that I am I'm caring for a friend's house and have been for about 6 months, but their cat is now back home and they're not there. And he's an older cat and has been just had surgery, was in a car traveling from New Orleans back to Los Angeles, you know, last week, had one day with his family home, and now is by himself again. And they had told me, you know, you check in on him, he'll be okay. And it's been interesting, because when I did visit him, I spent a little time, and he's very affectionate and very loves humans, loves being up in your face, literally here. And I don't know, I had the strangest feeling, you know, not only that he's old, but somehow this feeling that he's kind of coming to the end of his life. And so I spent the night there last night, and everything was fine. And they had told me he has been wandering around and yowling and kind of doing, you know, lonesome kitty at night. He had none of that with me. He stayed on the bed. He was no noise at all. I'm kind of just thinking, the feeling I get from him is that, again, that he's coming to the end, but that he doesn't, you know, that having someone there is important. So I'm going to go and spend tonight again, which is, you know, most people would think that would be odd, that you're, you know, uprooting your evening and spending a night, you know, away from your own home for an animal. But this, you know, he's a special animal, and he, you know, regardless if he was special or not, but it's so interesting the sense that we can get from other living things, what they may need or what they're feeling. You know, so again, anyway, I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you're trusting your heart there is very nice. Cat needs to be taken care of.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Forgive me, I'm new. I know not the customs of how many questions I'm allowed to ask or...
Ask away.
So, first, I remember you remember talking about how sitting with like this, you're thinking, but sitting with this, like you're listening.
Yes.
I would ask you this. So would it be better to think about your troubles, like to like think about like what's troubling you, or better to think about like listen to like others, what's going around you, and having like maybe get a sense of like what they're going through, what the insight that they might have, or trust your own insight? Because like you said, depending on the energies of like the other man, like if like you get like bad vibes from this person, you get bad energy, you can sense it. But how do you know if your intuition is correct or not in that sense, and what would be the consequences of that intuition?
Well, yeah, you know, it's about, we're learning to trust our heart. You know, and so you are the one who has you are the one who knows yourself, and that's why we do zazen in a way, and we learn to trust our intuition, to trust ourselves, and we learn to listen to that voice, that little voice that's telling us, you know, go to the left or go to the right, or just stand right where you are. You just learn how to do that. That's what this is, will happen with this practice.
All right. My second question. You said you were talking about how the turtles communicate with their eyes.
Yes.
Do you think it's better for us as people to communicate with our eyes versus just vocalizing what we're thinking? Or just, because I feel as if, this is just a feeling, I could be wrong in saying this, but what's your opinions on communication?
When I was a young man, just married, my wife said, open your mouth, talk more. He said, listen to the way that I am with my girlfriends. You know, we talk, and let each other know everything that's going on with us. She said, I want you to be able to do that with me. You know, but on the other hand, you know, there are also times, so that may be, you know, if you're with a woman, you know, or you may want to be able to express yourself well and know yourself well enough to be able to express what's going on with you, let them know. But, you know, then there's also times for silence. You know, there's times, you know, when I took a long walk with Copen and we didn't say a word. And there are other times when we drink 8 cups of coffee and talk our heads off. You know, so it's, you know, it can go both ways. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.